Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Ira Harris and Louis Vincent Gave. Ira is an independent trader, hedge fund manager, and global macro consultant trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also a CME director from 1997 to 2003 and is also currently a CME director. Louis co-founded Gave
Nope.
Cow.
I'm going.
Oh, is that right? Okay. Okay.
I lost the election. I forgot to tell you.
Oh, okay. Okay. Okay.
I have to be current.
Yep. Okay. And Louis co-founded Gave Cal in 1999 with his father, Charles, and Anatoly Kaletsky. Since 2005, he has mostly focused on the money management side of the business. Before co-founding Gave Cal, Louis worked for Bariba Capital Markets, where he was an equity research analyst from 1997 to 1999. Louis studied economics, history, and Chinese at Duke University and Nanjing University. In the past decade, Louis has written several books, including Two Different for Comfort. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you very much. Great to be
Thank
here.
You, Richard. Yep, this is another. You honor me with the people I get to sit with, so thank you
okay.
again.
Okay.
Great honor for me. Thank you.
Great. I thought we'd dive right in with a discussion on the U.S. dollar. Recently, Louis, you've talked about a stealth devaluation of the U.S. dollar. What do you make of the current strong U.S. dollar, and how do you see the dollar playing out?
Well, first of all, thanks. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a very nice to meet Ira, if only over the phone. But yeah, thanks again for having me. Look, I think the question of the U.S. dollar is always whenever you do macro trading, it's always the first question you have to answer. Frankly, it's that one and where are interest rates going, right? You get those two things right, interest rates and the dollar, and that's 99% of the battle. This year, I think it's in a sense. It's been a highly unusual year for all the reasons that we know. But it's for all, the crazy markets and crazy economic downturn that we're facing, the FX markets have been odd in that you've seen a massive divergence. On the one hand, you've had a number of emerging market currencies that have been absolutely smoked. You look at your Brazilian real, your Turkish liras, your Mexican pesos, your Indonesian rupiahs. I would say your more speculative emerging market currencies have been smoked. But meanwhile, the volatility on the major cross currencies has been very, very low. The euro US has basically hovered between 108 to 110. The yen has roughly hovered 107. The pound had a big dip in the rough weeks of early March, but basically we've been at around 122, give or take a few percent, for almost all the year. So it's been an interesting backdrop because obviously the world has turned upside down. You've had big increase in volatility in equity markets, big increase in volatility in bond markets. But if all you had on your screens were basically the yen, the euro, the sterling, you would have thought that this was the most boring year ever. Meanwhile, of course, in the backdrop, you have money printing going on such as the world has never seen. You have budget deficits that are absolutely blowing out of any historical precedents. And on that front, I think it's fairly obvious that the U.S. is now doing more than anybody else. If you look at U.S. monetary aggregates, USM2 is now growing 20% year on year. It's never grown by this much in the post-World War II era. And of course, the U.S. budget deficits are getting through the roof. So So you are seeing, against a background where all these currencies are going nowhere, and against a background of money printing that's going crazy, the one major currency that seems to break out seems to be gold, and increasingly silver as well. So it seems like most of the currencies are not moving very much against each other, but against gold, against silver, you are starting to see all these major currencies start to lose value.
And Naira, your thoughts? You've written also a lot about the U.S. dollar.
I just have to laugh to Lewis because, God, it's so many of the same conversations. But there's a, yeah, and I wrote a piece the other day. So everything that Lewis talked about, I certainly have been in agreement. But, and he's right, the dollar has been fairly stable, except against the emerging markets. And the emerging markets is where I think the global pain really stands to be felt even more, especially, it's like when, as I talked about, when Trump talked about a strong dollar, it defies any sense because the Fed and Congress is the unwilling to admit to what they're really doing. But the Fed's goal, as well as the ECB, of course, and the BOJ, is to create higher inflation levels. Well, with the world on a dollar standard, if you have a higher dollar, you are going to create more and more deflationary pressures. So you need a weaker dollar. And when I heard Trump, talk about, all of a sudden he did the pivot where he went from, a perennial dollar bear to talking up the dollar. And I read some of the reasons why some people thought it really brought me back to, Keynes' 1925 pamphlet on the economic consequences of Mr. Churchill. Because if you're trying to appreciate the dollar, to me, it's like Britain going back on the gold standard in 1925. And the real effect was, of course, strong deflationary forces that really harmed Britain, especially the greatest deflationary force was the pressure downward on wages. And I can't get people to understand this enough. Let's look at, as Lewis talked about, with the metals, they have certainly, and they're back in their role as currencies rather than commodities because they are a store of value. And in dire times, they are a medium of exchange, so they fit that purpose. But I went back and looked, and the Brazilian real is basically down about 40% from January 1st against the dollar. And then when you start to look at what Brazil is selling, massive amounts of soybeans, especially to Asia and especially to China. But when you compute soybeans in terms of real, soybeans are at all-time high, which puts more and more pressure on global prices because of the role of the dollar. And if you think you're helping the American farmer, you're not helping the American farmer because it's all being carried on his back. But I'll stop there and I'll make my case. And that's how I make my case for why the world needs a weaker dollar.
I thank you very much, Ira. There's no doubt that as I stated at the beginning, you get the dollar right. That's 90% of the battle. And that historically, of course, a strong dollar was usually bad news for emerging markets. A strong dollar is usually bad news for emerging markets because for a number of reasons, but the main two reasons is, number one, most people in emerging markets think in two currencies. They think in dollars and they think in their own currency. So when they see the dollar go up, they tend to basically sell their own assets. They refuse to invest domestically and just buy dollars. So it hits growth in emerging markets for that first reason. The second reason, of course, is most big projects in emerging markets are still funded in dollars. So a rising dollar basically means a rising cost of funding. It's a bigger hurdle to clear for any capital spending in emerging markets. So if you look at, you know, for those two reasons, to Ira's point, a strong dollar is bad news for emerging markets. And it is obviously very much in emerging markets' interest. It's, I think, in the interest of the United States and the interest of everyone today to indeed have a weaker dollar. One exception, perhaps, are Japan and Europe, who don't stand to benefit as much from a weaker dollar. But for the U.S., for emerging markets, which, let's face it, the U.S. and the emerging markets are the two potential zones of growth for the world. They have been for the past 30 years and will continue to be for the next 20 years. Your two sort of motors in the global economy are, on the one hand, the U.S. and then the other emerging markets. Both will tend to do better with a weaker dollar. And I think that explains a lot of the Fed's policies. What was very interesting to me is as you start to see all the emerging market currencies collapse, you know, your Brazilian real that Ira highlighted, your Mexican pesos, your Indonesian rupiah, etc. You saw the Fed not only, of course, give swap lines to the central bank with whom it typically does business, i.e. ECB, Bank of Canada, Swiss National Bank, Bank of England, and Bank of Japan, but further extend its swap lines to the Bank of Brazil, to the Monetary Authority of Singapore, to the Swedish National Bank, the Riksbank, and so on. So in essence, what this meant was that imagine your Bank of China or your DBS Bank or your Standard Chartered or your HSBC. You have a banking license in Singapore. And if for whatever reason you find yourself short the US dollar, you can now go to the MAS, the Monetary Authority of Singapore, and say, hey, I need some US dollars. And the MAS can turn around and just get them at the Fed. And so even Chinese banks basically now have an indirect access, or Indian banks or Russian banks through Stockholm now have an indirect access to basically the Fed's printing press through all these various central banks. And so as the dollars were running scarce at the beginning of March, the Fed basically stepped in and by providing swap lines to not only the top five central banks, but also the nine other central banks behind that, the Fed basically granted unlimited amounts of dollars almost to anybody in the world, for all intents and purposes. And of course, that kept the U.S. dollar's rally. And that's, of course, the big difference between today and the gold standard that Ira refers to, is that in the 1920s, the Bank of England couldn't print gold. So when Churchill brought, you know, the pound in a disastrous move, he reinstituted the gold standard for the sterling, hereby unleashing deflation onto the world. The Fed today, for me, is actually doing the opposite. Because they're standing there saying, look, you want dollars, come and get them. You know, we got a printing press back there, and we're not going to run out of ink. So you want them, you got them. And lo and behold, that perhaps helps explain why the volatility on the big cross exchange rates has been so muted, and why, even though emerging market currencies collapsed in the first phase of the COVID crisis, they now seem to be stabilizing.
Your thoughts, Ira?
No, that's right. And but I think, you know, and I think Lewis would agree that the Fed, while they don't speak to the dollar, but it was interesting when Powell sat with Posen, and the last question that Posen asked was, of course, was about the dollar and the swap lines. Of course, he didn't ask anything deeper, but yes, once they opened those swap lines, and it's more than ridiculous that they have swap lines with the Swiss National Bank, but they don't have swap lines with the Chinese, which is just pretty preposterous. Or we can go through a few others, too, that they don't have swap lines. Because why does the Swiss need swap lines with anybody? They have They have the best and most articulated printing press in the world. In fact, I argue that if the Fed had any brains, they would use the Swiss model, print all the money they could and start sending dollars by buying foreign assets all around the globe. I know that we would run afoul of 13-3, but you know what? Nobody cares about rules in this world anyway.
That's true.
You can circumvent whatever you want. They may as well do that. But you know what? Okay, the swap lines are in place, but evidently, you know, yes, and I agree that the emerging markets have, well, some of them have stabilized, and I think Mexico more, because I think Mexico is going to be the recipient of a lot of investment because of the change. I think the dramatic change is going to take place in the global supply chains, but that was what was supposed to happen anyway until the Chinese devalued on January 1st, 1994 by 50%, stole all the thunder out of a lot of different, out of the Asian tigers and certainly out of Mexico. So things will get righted here a little bit, but I think that the dollar, first of all, because the weaker dollar will get us, and we're starting to see it, interesting, even with the dollar not really, but commodity prices are starting to look interesting. I'm not going to go so far as to say that they're beyond that, but they are looking interesting. Even copper is now holding above 240 for the last few days. Maybe we'll get some more. But the world, and it's not from a trade standpoint. You know, Trump was about trade. And now you need it. And I think, Lou's point on the gold standard in 1925 was what the Brits and Hughes say, is you're on a dollar standard. Flood the world with dollars. But no, you've already admitted it doesn't matter. You just created $3-5 trillion in a very short period of time. Yeah, what's another two? We accomplished a weak dollar with the Plaza Accord with a hell of a lot less money. So I don't know. I think the world really, from a financial perspective, needs a weak dollar. But I know if we don't get one, everybody says, well, deflation. Well, if you want to bring on deflation faster and harder, keep having the dollar rally. And I promise you, deflation would be a much more dynamic force than most people are even willing to admit to.
No, I think all this is indeed very valid. Look, I'm, as a firm, we've been structural deflationists since the beginning, partly because being based in Asia and being based in China, we could see the unfolding deflationary pressures that China was unleashing onto the world. And that these deflationary pressures were actually accelerated post GFC, because the end result of the 2008 crisis was that China went on a capital spending boom of epic proportions, building roads, building railways, building ports and airports, so that all of a sudden you basically brought in an additional 500 million workers who were sitting in China's interior onto the global economy. And that, of course, for me is the big difference with today's crisis. If we compare the GFC of 2008 to the GLC of today, the great lockdown crisis, if we compare the GFC to the GLC, the big difference is, for me, the end result of the GLC will not be us bringing 500 million Chinese workers from the hinterland back and into the global economy, but very much instead pushing those 500 million workers back where they came from. As we start to see, obviously, the anti-China rhetoric heat up, as we try to see people start to say, well, look, when we export everything to China and we stretch our supply chains, we may be saving money in the short term, but there's actually some external costs in doing so that we haven't been taking into account, all of a sudden we can't produce masks anymore when we need them. All of a sudden we have new diseases show up out of nowhere. All of a sudden our economies are not very resilient to any kind of shock, so on and so forth. So, you know, for years we harvested the easy money that came from stretching our supply chains, and now we're all of a sudden realizing that there was actually a hidden cost that we never accounted for. And this year, of course, we're paying for that cost in droves. And so the world that had been massively deflationary for 20 years, for 25 years, for 30 years, because of China's emergence, is now most likely moving into another direction. So yes, to your point, you know, today we feel that there is, you know, no hurdle to continue printing money, whether we have budget deficits of 5 trillion or 7 trillion, who cares, what's the difference? For now, that's the case. I'm not so sure it'll still be the case in a year's time, though.
And so how do you see it playing out, Louis, in terms of deflation versus stagflation in the coming months? Do you see initially a period of deflation in the GLC post-COVID world, then morphing into a rising inflationary environment?
Well, look, I'm always a little worried when the market prices something with 100% certainty. You know, my starting point is we live in a world that is so complicated with so many different moving parts that having 100% certainty on anything always strikes me as being a risky proposition. Now, today, you know, you look at tips, and basically tips are pricing in less than 1% inflation in the U.S., every year for the next 10 years. And the tips are pricing that just at a time when we're basically going through an unprecedented expansion in U.S. budget deficits and an unprecedented expansion in monetary aggregates, and where we're basically, we haven't done it yet, but it increasingly looks likely that we're closing the door on the very globalization that brought us 20 years of deflation. And with all that, the market is pricing in deflation for as far as the eye can see. So is it a case that the market has a terrific crystal ball, or is the market just looking at the recent past and projecting that far into the future? I think it's much more of the latter. We're projecting the recent past far into the future. And while we may get some weak deflation numbers, and I'm not even sure, by the way, because, you know, everywhere you care to look, I see two things today. I see lots of supply chain disruptions on the one hand. And on the other, I see a behavior that's changing consumer behaviors that we haven't seen in a while, which is, you know, the beginning of hoarding. Now, hoarding is very much an inflationary type of behavior. You hoard because you fear there won't be enough for everybody. And so, you know, we start off by hoarding cleaning products. Well, first masks and gloves, then cleaning products, then meats. Now you can't find a freezer anywhere because people want to buy freezers to put their meat in. My belief is as soon as the confinements end in India, you're going to have half of the population that's going to rush to buy gold coins because that's typically what they do in India when things go badly. And right now they can't because they're all confined, but, you know, the gold coin shops are going to get swamped. Of global gold sales in any one year. So we have something new that we haven't seen before, which is hoarding. And that's for me is an important change in behaviors. And on the other side of that, yes, I do fear that inflation is going to be a problem much sooner than people expect, which, you know, when you have record high budget deficits funded by record high money printing, that's usually the end result. And by the way, that's a big difference also with the last decade. In the last decade, you had Europe go through austerity. You had the Tea Party in the U.S. that basically prevented Obama from getting any money, as a result of which U.S. government spending actually flatlined between 2010 and 2016, which is something it's very seldom done. all that is now out of the, and of course you had a big anti-corruption drive in China when Xi Jinping arrived in 2012, which is a sort of tightening of sorts. All that is now out of the window. Everywhere you care to look, government is trying to shove out as much money as quickly as possible out the door. That is not a deflationary type of behavior.
Interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, I agree with all that. And, you know, my premise, Richard, you know, for as long as I've been doing these podcasts, how long? 4 years now? Three, whatever. You know, when people would argue, well, gold, you know, needs inflation, I said, no, gold is going up because in a fiat currency world, where, of course, the only thing behind the fiat currency is the credibility of the policymakers and the central bank. But if you start to doubt the credibility, and I think that's really happened since 07, 08, when they saw the way the initial reaction was, that people, and that's what keeps gold bid, because ever since, you know, for all the animals, and I'm not a gold bug, and I don't think Louis is a gold bug, I haven't read their work. You were just real.
I'm not.
No, I see. I'm with you. I'd rather have gold at $40 because all would be right in the world, and I'd be.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But that's how I feel. But that's not the way. And we don't make the rules. We can only, you know, we can only plan the battlefield, and the terrain is given to us. So we don't know anything but that. But what I do know from having read Bernanke for years and years and years, is that his greatest fear, as the fear of all central bankers, is deflation. So they are going, and we're seeing it with Powell. They will push as hard and as hard. There's no limit to it because they fear deflation. So everybody says, well, we're going into deflation. Well, if we're going into deflation, the central banks have failed absolutely miserably in what they're trying to concoct, because they couldn't even get to, you know, by their measures, 2% inflation. But I agree with Louis that I think you're going to see some velocity to the money, which is going to send that. I think his point on the world labor market, and I've discussed this ad nauseum, which is why I've never been a fan of the Phillips curve, because the Phillips curve is devoid of a global perspective. All its assumptions are domestic. And for the last, since the fall of the Berlin Wall, we'll give it a date anyway, 1989, the ability, and we'll go back to 79 with the rise of Deng Xiaoping. Who's that? Is that me?
Sorry, hold on 2 seconds. Apologies.
Yeah, not sure.
Sorry, guys. That was me.
Yeah.
Apologies.
Okay. So we haven't had wage because we've had global capital chasing a worldwide workforce. So of course there's not a union in the world. Even the German unions capitulated to create Hartz IV in 2001. So I think that is going to turn. And I think Louis makes a very good point with that. When is the inflation going to rise? I don't know. It'll probably start with commodity prices though, because it's, again, people are chasing some type of asset. Not everything can go to the equity markets. Sorry, but we'll probably get a good indicator out of, I think, what has been one of the most depressed, even though they're terribly managed companies, are the global grain companies, you know, from Bungie to, Cargill's not publicly listed, but ADM, you know, and we'll start to see some of the movement there. So I am definitely in that camp, and that'll put the final leg up in the metals, but I think the metals have been performing outlandishly good for many other reasons. And, you know, and I'm not a believer that geopolitical events for gold are anything but a day trade, because if you would have bought gold on every outbreak of geopolitical tension, you'd be broke 1,000 times over. So it is more the underlying mal effects and of the central banks. And is it going to result in inflation this time? Yeah, I think so.
I want to pick up on a couple of things that Iris said here, because I think that's very interesting. The first is, you know, if you look at gold since the bottom of the last bear market in 2009, in March 2009. Gold has outperformed U.S. Treasuries. And I, you know, I think that's important. So basically, in the previous up cycle, gold did better than U.S. Treasuries. Now, if you look at, and I'm looking at the 10-year here. Now, if you look at the past year, the past 12 months, even though we've been in a market with just, you know, a collapse of economic growth, such as none of us could have expected or predicted, or, you know, the world has never seen, gold once again outperforms the U.S. Treasuries over the past 12 months. So there's, I think that's an important message. It's an important message because obviously we're in a gold bull market when you get this kind of outperformance. You know, if you start off with the premise that there's roughly two big anti-fragile asset classes out there, U.S. Treasuries being one, gold being the other, the two main things you can protect your portfolio with. When gold outperforms meaningfully every other asset class, that tends to continue until you see one of two things. Either a meaningful rise in the U.S. dollar, and we're not seeing that meaningful rise today against the big currencies as we discussed earlier, number one, or a sharp rise in Fed fund rates, basically the Fed starting a significant tightening cycle. And we're obviously very far from that today. So the first thing is, you know, gold has started a bull market, and it's not obvious what ends it here. I think there's lots of reasons why you could see it continued going, not least of which M2 growing at 20% year on year. But, you know, it's not obvious to me what stops it. And then I want to go back to this question of, you know, of inflation, because, you know, listening to Ara, I was reminded by one of my very first clients, a very famous investor, always used to tell me, when the Fed worries about something, I start to worry about something else. I think that's fair. And so, you know, the Fed has been worried about deflation for a while. And frankly, you could say, well, being worried about deflation has paid off because you've done great with bonds. But actually, you've done better if you were in gold. And you've done better if you were even in U.S. equities since the Fed was really worried about deflation at the end of 2008, early 2009. And that brings me to the point about inflation and how we measure inflation. You know, we measure inflation as this basket of commodity price. Well, you know, this consumer price index. And, you know, some of that, of course, you could say, well, today with my $100 bill, I can buy a lot more gasoline than I could 10 years ago. I can buy more natural gas or more heating oil than I could 10 years ago. But of course, I can buy a lot fewer income producing assets than I could 10 years ago. I can buy a lot fewer shares of companies than I could 100 years ago. I can buy a lot less 10 years ago, sorry. I can buy a lot less real estate than I could 10 years ago. And, you know, pretty much, yes, you know, the CPI hasn't gone up, but everything else, you know, your real estate, your local taxes, your cost of education, your cost of healthcare, all these things have gone up meaningfully, so much so that, you know, when you look at the yellow jacket movement in France, when you look at the riots in Hong Kong, when you look at the riots in Barcelona or in Beirut or everywhere around the world, they all have basically the same underlying message, which is we can't make ends meet. We can't afford to live in our own cities anymore. You know, this is the message that you hear from before we had the COVID crisis. We were having political riots all over the place with always the same message is I can't afford to live here. And so for all the talk about how there's no inflation, there's a whole lot of riots going on about people telling you that they can't make ends meet. And I don't know if that's a problem of how we decide to measure the inflation and somehow, you know, avoid the elephant in the room, which is the fact that for almost everyone now, real estate has become completely unaffordable. And if that's not inflation, then I don't know what is.
Irene, your thoughts?
No, Lou's right, because it's selective asset price inflation. We've seen it, you know, and it is. So if it's in the equity market, everybody cheers that. But it's still, what it does is, did the COVID epidemic cause this crisis? I would argue no, but it was a catalyst. But the crisis was caused by way too much leverage, and I'm speaking in global terms, because of the policies, well, I would say emanating from the Fed, the Japanese were not big enough to affect that, maybe in different pockets somewhere. But the Fed certainly, which lent to massive amounts of borrowing, look, nothing says it more. And I'll use the IFF, even though whether or the BIS numbers on borrowings in emerging markets are up to $11-12 trillion. This is a massive amount of leverage. Corporate America went into this leverage. And as we're finding out, the U.S. consumer, and I've argued this with you, not with you, but with some of the people when we've done some podcasts, Richard, unemployment was 3.5%, which was everybody's barometer of the health of the American consumer. But they were carrying so much debt, because my point was, well, if everything's so good, why is credit card debt being priced at over 17%? So there, and now it's all been shown to be right. Why is really the problem with the massive rise in unemployment is that the average consumer doesn't have enough savings to fall back on, and in fact is in debt. And they're trying to figure this out, which is why this is going to have more staying power. And Powell knows it as well as anybody. They were in easy mode at 3.5% unemployment. 3.5%. We from the Powell pivot of January 2019. We've done some very aggressive measures, as even Draghi's last gift was, of course, increasing the QE of the ECB. So we've had all of this going on, and that was at, even Europe had fairly low unemployment relative to where they were. Japan has been at low unemployment. So Swiss certainly have low unemployment, and yet, what are these banks going to do when we sit? And I'm being somewhat optimistic here, even if we sit at 9, 10, 11% unemployment for the next year, year and a half, tell me what takes place. And to Louis' point about riots, I believe, because being a child of the 60s, sorry, Louis, I'm that old, and having more in common with the Global 68 order, I was only 15 years old, but I was politically involved and being aware. And I think that this is going to be a phenomenally hot summer in the United States. I think urban areas are going to see political action like we haven't seen literally in 50 years or so. And I'd be paying close attention, especially because everybody wants to make a statement during a presidential election. So the stock market is in la-la land. I don't know what they think they're looking at. But I'm not nearly that Pollyannish about what's going to take place here, because what we have done, and I'm talking about systemically, what we have done with the rise in unemployment in such a rapid fashion from 3.5% to probably 20, 21, or 22%, that comes with massive political ramifications.
I agree with all of that. I think what's interesting when you look at the stock market today is that on the one hand, you've got banks, in the U.S. and basically around the world that are down, let's call it 40, 50% for the year, that are by and large trading below book value. I mean, in the U.S., around book value. Elsewhere, away from the U.S., you're trading at like 0.5 book value. So you've got banks that are telling you, and I've always liked to look at banks as a sort of indicator for the broader health of the economy, and that, you need the banks are sort of your heart, right? And without a strong heart, it's hard to run a marathon. And without strong banks, it's hard to to develop much in the way of decent economic growth. And so when I look at the banks in, you know, all, everywhere around the world, if that was my only indicator I had on my screen, I would say, wow, things are really bad. You know, economies are looking very sick. Markets are looking very sick. But yes, to Ira's point, you've got the NASDAQ that's basically ballpark up for the year. And the S&P that, you know, that's just marginally down for the year. And we all know why that is. It's, you've got a handful of stocks that investors have all rushed in on the premise that, you know, in this, these uncertain times, I want to own the big monopolies that I know will be able to deliver profits almost regardless of what happens. To me, that strikes me as a dangerous strategy in that, first, monopolies in the capitalist system seldom stay monopolies for very long, either because the rents that they capture attract competitors, and that's the healthy route, or because governments are jealous of their power and they go after monopolies. So that's the unhealthy route. But either for this reason, but also because historically, you know, being in very crowded trades, you know, you look at through history, it's seldom been the path to riches. It can be the path to riches for a year, 2 years, 3 years. It's seldom the path to riches for 10 or 20 years. Being in the most crowded trade, and you know, the most obvious way you can look at that is you look at the top 10 market cap in the world at the end of each decade, and you know, in the 1980s, 6 out of the 10 were energy stocks. In 1990, 8 out of the 10 were Japanese stocks, and 6 out of those 8 were Japanese banks. In 2000, it was tech. In 2010, it was basically China plays. You had the big Chinese banks, you had PetroChina, et cetera, in there. Today, of course, in 2020, it's all about U.S. tech. Maybe this decade will be the one that that confirms the fact that, you know, maybe it'll be the exception to the rule that running into crowded trades is usually a path to losing money more than making it. But I doubt it. Somehow it's either the governments that, that do it in for you or simply the way the capitalist system works. Making money by doing what feels good and what feels warm and where you're crowded with everybody else and you feel you're taking no risk is usually a very challenging proposition.
Oh, interesting thoughts. And your final thoughts, Ira?
Well, that I can't speak to, you know, because that's not the type of analysis that I do, but I truly respect what we're going to say. And it is interesting, you know, when they talk about herd immunity, I always want to be immunized from the herd on Wall Street because I know that doesn't really work well. So, you know, but that's why, you know, that's why I work the way I do with this, and because I try to, you know, find my, you know, a path based on, yes, history tells us what took place before, as Howard Marks has recently, you know, so lovely laid out, and forecasting what's going to come out from that is always difficult. But if you're well grounded and have done a lot of work, there, what you can do is just really work to increase the probabilities of various outcomes, which is all we tried to do. And if we do that well, we'll be successful. And I've evidently done it well enough that I'm still here after all these years. But I, you know, where this is going to go, again, I do think we're going to see commodity inflation only because, and I make this point, and I don't know whether you speak to this, but when the big macro, global macro hedge funds, the Kovners, Druckenmiller, Tudor, that am I old, when they start doing well, which they're doing well right now, and they get some wind in their sail, and I use that, you know, because it powers you. And I don't think that the global macro crowd, which I consider myself a part of, nowhere to the level of the people I named, of course. But when you start doing well and making money, you get wind in your sail and you start pushing things. And right now, I think the algos are on their heels because they took some meetings based on some of their low vol strategy, you know, their vol selling strategies and some other, even the risk parity. But the global macro titans, when they get wind in their sail, they will start pushing things. And I think one of the areas they're going to be pushing is acquiring assets. And a lot of those assets are going to be commodity assets that have global use and global needs. So I'm going to be very attentive to that. And that can help. Look, at the central banks are frozen. They're not moving. If you got inflation of 6%, you think the Fed's raising rates in this environment with 9% unemployment, 8% unemployment, 10% unemployment, not a chance in the world. They're going to have, and that's actually Rogoff. He backs off of it, but when you read This Time is Different, the solution to so much of that was what he talked about, 6% inflation for, you know, 3 to 5 years would do a lot to alleviate the pileup of debt. And that's right, because we still remain plagued by debt, and there's nothing worse than a world saddled with too much debt, of course, in deflation. And I think the deflation scare is real, but I'm not in that camp thinking that it really takes hold. So I'm leaning the other way, where this time it just won't be equity assets or real estate, because real estate is going to have its own problems. And I thought that before this, because I thought WeWork was going to be a phenomenally disruptive force on real estate prices, because they had taken so much off the market, and then we're going to bring it all back on because that model was really being called into question. So the banks are they're hogtied for quite a while. They're not going to be able to move. If these forces start to be unleashed, I think that a lot of these large global macro titans are going to have their way with the market, and we're going to see some very interesting movement across the board in commodity prices.
And your final thoughts?
I fully agree. All right. Yeah, if it's I've got one fun story for you. Of all the commodities, I'm probably the most bullish on copper, and for a number of reasons, including the tight supply and the fact that there's been very little investment in new copper mines over the past 6-7 years. The fact that if we want to electrify as rapidly as we say we do, all of our cars, et cetera, there's not enough carbon and all these forces. But I'll leave you with one last fun thought on copper is, I don't know if you're into architecture and decor, et cetera, but obviously in the 1920s and 30s, the big trend, was Art Deco, and you put copper everywhere. Copper handles, copper handlebars, copper rails in buildings, et cetera. And the main reason for that was that germs don't survive on copper. Right. They basically die almost immediately. And so following the Spanish flu of 1918 to 1920, we started putting copper everywhere. And it basically became, in all public buildings, department stores, bars, everything you put copper on. And that was the big copper boom years. Following COVID, I wouldn't be surprised if we start going back to putting copper on all public, the handlebars of all public buildings. Even if copper is expensive, it'll still be cheaper than what we just did. So here's a fun thought to finish this off for you.
Well, I happen to agree with you, but I've been somewhat bullish since it went down to 215, 220. I've been just watching it because I need to get a better technical picture, although the last couple of days did provide some of that thrust. And you heard it today in the Senate hearing with Powell and Mnuchin. I'll make you even more bullish, because when you think about it, they are going to do a massive infrastructure build-out, which will, I think, create huge demand. I think you're starting to see some of it in silver because silver, you know, they just could not commoditize silver. So they didn't treat it as a monetary phenomenon, totally a commodity. So they used it as a selling hedge. And when we went to 120 ounces of silver to an ounce of gold, it was, wow, you know, because the previous high, I think, was about 98.5. So we went to 120. I go, but it was just saying that, well, there's not going to be any demand about any commodities. So they were just using that as their, as a hedge against a gold position. And both were doing pretty well, but we're seeing that we got down to like 97.5 today. So we had a pretty good move relative. But I think that we're going to see massive infrastructure projects. And like you said, it's not from China this time. I think between Europe and the United States and maybe a couple other places, instead of burning all this cash by trying to just give people enough to sustain themselves and not get into any type of tighter credit situation, there is going to be massive infrastructure spending. And that, to me, is going to lift copper. It's, you know, I don't know, you know, what stocks you, but, you know, one of my favorite, the only because they've paid down a lot of debt, is, of course, Glencore. Because I look at Ivan Glasenberg and go, and I pay attention to it. And I know they paid down debt, and but they run afoul of a lot of political regimes. But those are the type of companies I think, you know, again, Freeport-McNamara, phenomenally low price. You know, it's been so underappreciated. But if you're right, their copper holdings make them a really good takeover target.
I own both.
Sorry, I didn't know. But
all good. No, keep talking them up.
I don't have that type of input.
Just running out of time here, but how can our listeners learn more about your work, Louis?
So the easiest way is to go to our website. I don't have much of a social media presence. So the best way to keep tabs is just to go to our website, which is gavkal.com. That's a G-A-V-E-K-A-L, K for kilo. So G-A-V-E-K-A-L.com.
Great. And Ira?
Same place, Notes from Underground. That's my only – well, I don't really tweet, but other people tweet my workout. But Notes from Underground is the blog, and you know, YRAHARRIS.com. We'll get you there. And I do the podcast with you, Richard, and of course with White Wave and with Anthony Credelli. So you know, I'm out there via that. Yep. But you know, it's to have these kinds of discussions with people like Louis and his dad, who read his stuff over the years, because there wasn't a person in Switzerland, and I knew a lot of the Swiss bankers during my day who didn't have great respect for them. Well, that's true. It's true.
Thank you very much.
I'm sure we know many of the same people because they were always talking about, you know, who was their go-to. So
thank you.
That's high praise from some very important people.
Great. Thank you very much. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thanks, Richard.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only, and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.